And so those first captives that did go back to Israel, by Cyrus's decree in Ezra 1, they rebuilt the temple, and that was completed in Ezra 6. And when they finished that, we were told about the people, and they observed the Passover in the following month after the completion of the temple. And it tells us in Ezra chapter 6 and verse 21 that those children of Israel that were come again out of captivity, and all such as had separated themselves unto them from the filthiness of the heathen of the land to seek the Lord God of Israel. They were the ones that ate of the Passover at that time. But we can see the mind of those people. They had determined that they were going to be holy to the Lord and seek Him. And so they were, they understood that they could not be like those nations that were around them. Just like us today, and this is the reason the Lord tells us about this. We're in the world. It's God's will that we be here to be the light of it and the salt of it. But if we are of the world while we're in it, then what kind of light are we? Or what kind of flavor, salt, are we? We will not have any. We will be salt that has lost its flavor if we are just like the world. We're serving we're not fulfilling God's purpose for us to be in this world. So, as we know, Jesus prayed in John 17 on his last night on the earth that though we are in the world, as it is God's will that we be in this world, his prayer was that while we are in it, we would not be of it. Because there is a big difference between being in the world and being of the world. Those ones that God's people there in Ezra 6, they were in the world, but was their mind to be of it, or were they in it but not of it? Well, they were in it but not of it. They had separated themselves from the filthiness of the land. But now here we are a few years later into the next generation, and these princes of the Israelites there report to Ezra upon his arrival that the people now were had not separated themselves from the people of the lands, and they were doing according to the ways and the abominations of all those nations around them. So had a change taken place from what we read in Ezra 6, verse 21, and what we read now in Ezra chapter 9, and verse 1. Big change has occurred now in just a rather short period of time, just within a few years. They were in the world, but not of the world. Back there in Ezra 6, 21, but now in Ezra 9 and verse 1, they're in it and what else? They are in it and of it. I mean, how much distinction in that description there in verse 1 of chapter 9, how much distinction or difference is there between these people and what they're doing and those other nations from what's being described? They're doing according to those same abominations. What got them in trouble in the first place to such that the Lord had only preserved a very remnant, a small number of all that had been of the children of Israel? In our minds, if we think, well, the Israelites, they went bad and then God punished them by sending them to Babylon into captivity. Well, that's really not an accurate view or understanding of what actually happened. Yes, they did go astray from him, doing exactly like what is described here. That's what got them in trouble with the Lord in the first place. But all but a tiny portion of them, only a small portion of them, went to Babylon to captivity. So the accurate way to understand the description in God's word of what happened to those people when they turned away from him, not that they went into captivity, they died. God destroyed by sword, famine, and pestilence almost all of them. It was only a small number, a basket of what he called good figs that he preserved into captivity in Babylon. So those were the ones that God worked with and gave the hearts to know him, and they repented and turned to him, those are the ones that went back under Zerubbabel that had that mind to be different than what they had been before. That they were going to seek the Lord and not be partake of or touch the unclean, the filthiness of the land and of all those abominations. They were not going to do those things. So those were the people that repented. But how long did it take before the lessons that had been learned were now being forgotten again? And as we go back through the history of Israel, and that's a large subject covering many, many books that we have been engaged in for quite some time. I expect Sister Margie, if we really wanted to get the exact exact time when we started the book, studying way back to the book of Joshua when we first started this study of these books that record the history of the nation of Israel, because Israel as a nation, it was given birth as a nation by the Lord with the Exodus from Egypt. That's when they became a distinct nation, and the Lord started their calendar with that being their the beginning of their months to commemorate, to go along with their beginning as a separate nation as they left Egypt. And so it was under Joshua that they went into Canaan and conquered the land. And so that really begins the study of the people of Israel as a nation that had upon whom God fulfilled all those promises that he had made to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, their fathers. So from that time, from when they entered the land of Canaan and conquered it, through the entire period of the Judges, that 450 year period, all the way from there to 600 whatever years under the kings. So we're looking at about 1,000 to 1,100 years of history of the children of Israel under the Old Testament to where we are now. That's a lot of generations, but from all of that time, going back to what we saw under the judges, what happened? I mean, what was the? It was a cycle that got repeated over and over again, wasn't it? Beginning with that first generation that entered into the land of Canaan under Joshua, and we did look a little bit at this last week, so to revisit for a moment. In the book of Joshua, chapter 23, verses 11 to 13, we saw there's a warning that God gave through Joshua, who was a prophet of the Lord, yes, and also their judge. So he was the second judge. We might kind of think of the period of the judges beginning with after Joshua, but no. The Lord refers to Joshua and Moses before him as judges. So Moses was the first, then Joshua. But through Joshua, the one who led them into Canaan, under whose leadership God gave them the land of Canaan, they conquered that. So verses 11 to 13 of Joshua 23, Joshua told the people, "Take good heed, therefore, unto yourselves that you love the Lord your God. Else, if you do in any wise go back and cleave unto the remnant of these nations, even these that remain among you, and shall make marriages with them and go in unto them and they to you, know for a certainty that the Lord your God will no more drive out any of these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps unto you, and scourges in your sides, and thorns in your eyes, until you perish from off this good land which the Lord your God hath given you." Well, what ended up happening? In the book of Judges, the next book, which is, if you've got an old-fashioned Bible in your hands, nothing electronic, a couple of pages later, Judges chapter 2, in verses 7 through 13, it says, "And the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord that he did for Israel. And Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died, being 110 years old, and they buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres in the Mount Ephraim on the north side of the hill Gaash. And all that generation were gathered unto their fathers. So that generation of the children of Israel, were they wicked or righteous? They were righteous. They served the Lord. And it says that the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders that outlived Joshua. So those ones that came into the land and that conquered it, they saw all that God had did. These were ones that had been the little ones. They were young when they left Egypt. But they had seen all of, Joshua and the ones with him, they saw what the Lord did. They saw the 10 plagues, the parting of the Red Sea. They saw the water come forth from the rocks. They saw the manna fall, to the ground from the sky 6 days a week for over 40 years until they saw all the works that God did to bring them into Canaan and give them the land. I mean, how many of the great works of the Lord had they seen? And then he refers to that generation had seen the works of the Lord, all the great works of the Lord that he did for Israel. Well, they had seen all of that. They lived through all of that, and that generation served the Lord. Where their children come along now? Did their children see the 10 plagues in Egypt? Did their children see the parting of the Red Sea? Did they walk through, or did they get carried through on through that dry ground in the midst of the sea to the other side? Did they partake of that manna in the wilderness? Did they... were they there to see all that God did? Did they see the walls of Jericho fall down? Did they see all that God did to give them those victories over those nations in Canaan to deliver the land to them? No, they didn't see those things with their own eyes. Well, neither have we. Is that an excuse? Well, I didn't see it personally, so therefore... I don't have to be concerned about it. I don't have to know about that, and I don't have to serve the God that did that. Is that an excuse? Is that okay? Well, no. The Lord has told us about all of those things so that we would all know about them, whether we saw them with our own eyes or not. And he says we're blessed, though we haven't seen. Same with our Lord Jesus Christ when he was on this earth. I mean, did we see him walk on the water? Did we see him raise the dead? Did we see the empty tomb? I mean, did we see all of that with our own eyes? Of course, we did not. But we have that preserved for us. So it's not an excuse to have not seen it. Now, for the ones who actually saw it and experienced it, did that make a difference for them? It obviously did. He points that out. But then their children come along. And so... he says, and there arose another generation after them which knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. Well, they hadn't seen them with their own eyes. And as we've pointed out, there's obviously was a failure in the teaching by their parents so that they had a problem. They had ignorance. They were ignorant of the things that God had done. Perhaps their parents, it was so obvious to them, they had seen it, but as far as they're teaching the children to know those things that the Lord had done and who he was, that teaching wasn't done sufficiently. They were not properly grounded in the Word of God to know those things. And what was the effect of that? Generation that arose after them that knew not the Lord, nor yet the works which he had done for Israel. And he says, and the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord and served Balaam, and they forsook the Lord God of their fathers, which brought them out of the land of Egypt, and followed other gods of the gods of the people that were round about them, and bowed themselves unto them, and provoked the Lord to anger. And they forsook the Lord and served Baal and Ashtaroth. Now, what was the reason that generation Well, we can see what prepared them for that destruction and turning to be of the world while they were in it, that ignorance. But what was it that attracted them and made it, what tool did the devil use to lure them into the world and to make them so well acquainted with the ways of those nations so that they so willingly followed them and adopted those ways and became like them? Well, that's what Judges chapter 3, the next chapter, tells us in verses 1 through 7, where he says, "Now these are the nations which the Lord left to prove Israel by them." It was a test. He says, "Even as many as Israel as had not known all the wars of Canaan, only that the generation of the children of Israel might know to teach them war, at the least such as before knew nothing thereof." Namely, so here are the nations that God left. Five lords of the Philistines and all the Canaanites and the Sidonians and the Hivites that dwelt in Mount Lebanon from Mount Baal Hermon under the entering in of Hamath. And they were to prove Israel by them to know whether they would hearken unto the commandments of the Lord which he commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. And the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites, Hittites and Amorites and Perizzites and Hivites and Jebusites. Now, what had Joshua warned in chapter 23 that we just read a moment ago? What did he tell the people to take heed? And what did he specifically warn them not to do that would cause them to forget the Lord and turn away from him and become like those nations? Yeah, he told them, and specifically, don't marry them. Don't marry their sons and daughters. Don't marry them, and your children are not to intermarry with them. What more powerful way can the devil tie one of God's children to the world than by marrying one of them? I mean, that is what Joshua very specifically warned them not to do. And then what does it tell us here in Joshua chapter 3, verses 6 and 7, after telling us how that they dwelt among them? It says, "And they took their daughters to be their wives, and gave their daughters to their sons, and served their gods. And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and forgot the Lord their God, and served Balaam in the groves." So Joshua had warned them. He had told them not to marry the people of those nations. He says, "Else if you do in any wise go back and cleave unto the remnant of these nations, even these that remain among you, and shall make marriages with them and go into them, and they into you, know for a certainty that the Lord your God will no more drive them out from before you, and there'll be snares and traps to you." Well, they didn't listen to that. They married them, and what happened? They became like them. I mean, they were married into them. I mean, they married the world, and they became like it. I mean, now if we were to read it the way, how many Christians today make the same mistake, commit the same error? How many Christians have married somebody of the world, and they're saying, "Yes, I fully understand that I, as a child of God, should not be joined together with one of these of the world, because this is against the Lord's plan, and this is going to be a source of temptation to my soul, and likely lead to my children learning the ways of the world and going astray." I mean, how many Christians enter into a marriage with somebody of the world with that kind of acknowledgement? Doesn't happen. We don't work that way. We work according to, like he says in Proverbs 21:2, "Every way of a man is right in his own eyes." We rationalize things. We come up with excuses for things and are able to convince ourselves that what we're doing is okay because whatever we come up with there. But how many Christians convince themselves they're going to convert that that person of the world that they marry. They're going to convert them, and everything's going to be great. Well, we don't read here that they took the daughters to be their wives and gave their daughters to their sons and converted all of them to worshiping the Lord. So it actually expanded the number of followers of God. I mean, that's not the record that that he gives there, is it? Who gets converted? Because there's already been at least enough of a conversion to rationalize doing that in the first place. So how much further down the slippery slope does it take for a child of God who's already rationalized that and then married somebody that's of the world to then slip away and learn their ways and follow them? And even if they don't, what happens with their children? I mean, their children learn those ways. So it doesn't bring more people to the Lord. It takes people of the Lord away from the Lord. That's what happened there. Now we might think, well, Joshua was a wise old man, a very good judge for Israel, and he was. But we don't want to think, well, he just came up with that wonderful wisdom on his own when he was warning the people not to marry them, and then we read about how they didn't listen and did so anyway, and then exactly what Joshua warned them about is what actually happened. Well, that didn't originate with Joshua. It came from the Lord, as we would expect. God gave commandment, and this applies to the situation very directly to what we're reading about now in Ezra chapter 9. But going back to the book of Deuteronomy in chapter 7, verses 1 through 6, Deuteronomy 7, 1 to 6, the Lord had commanded them the things that they should and shouldn't do when they entered into the land of Canaan among those people. Now we could take it back even further. In Genesis 15, when God spoke to Abraham, this was not the first time that he spoke to Abraham concerning giving the promises that he was going to make of his seed a great nation that would be like the sand on the seashore and the stars in the sky for multitude, he would multiply them, and that he was going to give them that land that that God had brought Abraham to. He had promised. We can go back to chapter 12 when he first promised Abraham those things, but in chapter 15 he did so again, gave more detail about what was going to happen. That they were not going to, that those descendants of Abraham were not going to remain there in Canaan, but they were going to sojourn in a foreign land. He didn't name Egypt there, but of course that's where they went. That's the nation they sojourned, and he told them they would do that for 400 years, they were going to be afflicted in that land. They became slaves to the Egyptians over time there. They had very hard bondage, and that's what God delivered them from. But as far as the timing and why it went 400 years, he told Abraham, he said, because the wickedness of the Amorites was not yet full, complete. So he was going to utterly destroy those people in Canaan when he gave the land to Abraham's descendants. Well, that happened under Joshua, but going by what God had said in Genesis 15, we know what the spiritual situation was of those nations that were in that land at that time. Since God said he was not going to give the land to Abraham's children until the wickedness of the Amorites was complete, when he gives the land to them now, what does that mean regarding their degree of wickedness, the level of wickedness that was there in the land? Was it just bad, or was it fully wicked? They were fully wicked. They were completely wicked. Their wickedness had become, wasn't just partial, it wasn't even mostly. It was a complete wickedness such that they were worthy of the sentence that God placed upon them, utter destruction. So that's how bad it was as far as among those nations at the time. And this is when he's speaking these words to the children of Israel through Moses. And so this was on the eve of their entering into the land of Canaan. So this is the spiritual condition of the land. That's the background where God says these words in Deuteronomy 7, 1 through 6. When the Lord thy God shall bring thee into the land whither thou goest to possess it, and hath cast out many nations before thee, the Hittites, and the Girgashites, and the Amorites, and the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, and the Hivites, and the Jebusites, seven nations greater and mightier than thou. And when the Lord thy God shall deliver them before thee, thou shalt smite them and utterly destroy them. Thou shalt make no covenant with them, nor show mercy unto them. Neither shalt thou make marriages with them. Thy daughter thou shalt not give unto his son, nor his daughter shalt thou take unto thy son. For they will turn away thy son from following me, that they may serve other gods. So will the anger of the Lord be kindled against you and destroy thee suddenly. But thus shall ye deal with them. Ye shall destroy their altars and break down their images and cut down their groves and burn their graven images with fire. For thou art a holy people unto the Lord thy God. The Lord thy God hath chosen thee to be a special people unto himself above all people that are upon the face of the earth. That's what he told them. So God had forbidden the marriage for them to marry those people of those nations. And what did he give as the reason why? If they did that, what would happen? They would turn away from the Lord. They would be converted by them and turn away from the Lord. So he told them that. Did Joshua believe that? Yes. And then when they've entered the land, what does he tell them? Now they're there among them, and he tells them again, don't start marrying these people, or you're going to become like them and turn away from the Lord, and the Lord's anger is going to be stirred up against you. Well, then Joshua dies and all those elders that were of that generation. And what do their children do? Do exactly what they were told not to do. They married those people. And what happened? Should it be a big shocker to us to see that exactly what God said would happen if they did that happened when they did that? Should it be a big shocker that man wouldn't listen to the Lord and then ended up having the very things that the Lord had warned against come upon them? I mean, how often do we do that? But that's what they did. That's what happened to them. And as we noted, this isn't the first time in history. And of course, the point being, this applied specifically, these were commandments to the children of Israel, and we saw in the example of that generation that entered the land of Canaan in the first place under Joshua, how long did it take before the people forsook the Lord? I mean, look at the faith they had, that generation that came in the beginning that said that they had seen the Lord's works. Did they have faith in God, and did they serve him all their days? They did. They had a great zeal for the Lord, and they did that all of their days. How long did it take for things to go bad? Are we going to say, well, as strong as they were, it was going to take many generations before that all was going to be forgotten and go away and the people reject the Lord? No, it didn't take long at all, did it? Their children, by being convinced by the devil to marry those people by ignoring what God had said and forbidden them to do, and then they became like the nations around them. Very fast. Well, on down the line, through the history of the judges, that was the cycle. So after that generation turned away from the Lord delivered them into the hand of their enemies. They were under the dominion of those, one of those nations until they repented and they would cry to the Lord, and then the Lord would raise up a judge to deliver them when they had repented. And then they would serve the Lord. That generation would serve the Lord during the time of that judge. And then when that judge would die, like Joshua did, and the generation that was under that judge's leadership and followed the Lord during that time, then their children would come along, and what would happen again? Same thing. And then the Lord would bring them under the dominion of another one of their enemies. And then the cycle would repeat itself. And and that's what the whole book of Judges tells us about. One generation after another, that cycle would be repeated over and over again. And this was not the first time in the history of God's people that such had happened. So when God gave that commandment specifically to the children of Israel in Deuteronomy 7... And by the way, we shouldn't neglect to read what he also instructed in Deuteronomy 23, 3 through 6, regarding the Ammonites and the Moabites. These were the children of Lot, so they weren't included in those seven nations of Canaan. Because what did God tell the children of Israel to do with those seven nations that were in the land of Canaan? Well, he told them things to do and not to do. Don't marry them. What to do? Destroy all of their altars, all of their images, and them. He commanded them to utterly destroy them. We just read that in Deuteronomy 7. They were worthy of that punishment by their complete and utter wickedness that they had attained. So that was for those nations. Well, there were other neighbors of theirs. The Moabites and Ammonites, those were the two nations that descended from Lot through his daughters, and were the children of Israel instructed to utterly destroy the children of Lot? No, they were forbidden from doing so. Yet the Lord also forbade them from marrying the people of those nations, Lot's descendants. Deuteronomy 23, 3 through 6. He says, an Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord, even to their 10th generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord forever. Now, 10 generations is a long time, isn't it? I could ask in this room how many people in here know, and this would go back to like your great, 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 eight times grandparents. You know how far back that would go? That would go back to around the early 1600s from where we are now. That's over 400 years. So, and in fact, he says even to, he doesn't say, well, then they can come in. Now the sentence has been completed and you can open the gates and in come the Moabites and the Ammonites. No, he says even to that. So that's why he said forever, permanently. So this was a perma-ban on having the Ammonites or the Moabites among them. So could they marry them? They were not supposed to do that. So he said, an Ammonite or Moabite shall not enter into the congregation of the Lord, even to their 10th generation shall they not enter into the congregation of the Lord forever. Why? Because they met you not with bread and with water in the way when you came forth out of Egypt, and because they hired against thee Balaam, the son of Beor, of Pethor of Mesopotamia, to curse thee. Nevertheless, the Lord thy God would not hearken unto Balaam, but the Lord thy God turned the curse into a blessing unto thee, because the Lord thy God loved thee. Thou shalt not seek their peace nor their prosperity all thy days forever. Well, that's what God said about the Moabites and Ammonites. They couldn't destroy those nations. God gave an inheritance to Lot's children. But the Lord had commanded them to keep themselves separate from those two nations in particular. Well, they were wicked. I mean, that's why they did what they did and why God brought that sentence on them, made that commandment there. We can see some specific commandments regarding the nations of Canaan that were supposed to be utterly destroyed. But did God want his people mingling with any of those wicked people around them? No, he did not. In the book of Genesis, chapter 6, as we know, going back to what led to the flood, what led to the utter destruction of all the world, where there were only 8 righteous people left in the entire earth, and what had led to that, the spiritual decline in Israel, I mean, not Israel, but among God's people in that time before the flood. Well, as we know, Genesis 6, 1 and 2 says, "It came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth, and daughters were born unto them, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose." And then verses 5 through 7 describes the resulting wickedness that was on the earth, to where God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Does that sound like the wickedness of the people had become complete, to where they were worthy of the utter destruction that God brought upon the world at that time? Well, how more complete can your wickedness be if every imagination of the thought of your heart is only evil continually? I mean, look at all the everys and onlys. Every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. How can you get worse than that? There wasn't even a fleeting idle thought of righteousness that fluttered in for a moment and then got swatted or squashed. That didn't even happen. I mean, there was no room for even giving any thought to that at all. And even 100 years of Noah preaching righteousness to the people, I mean, when that was introduced to them, what did they do with that? I mean, they were completely resistant to that. They would not listen to any of the warnings at all. And so, of course, that's what grieved God at his heart and made him decide to do what he did. And only 8 people of the world were saved. Well, how did the entire world in such a short time reach a point where every imagination of the thoughts of man's heart was only evil continually? Well, the sons of God, those children of God, those men that were following God, they saw those pretty women that were those daughters of men. They looked nice, but what kind of heart did they have? What was on the outside, did it match up with what was on the inside? No. They may have been pretty, but the situation wasn't. And what happened when they married those pretty wicked women? And it did, fully. And it took the world down to that level in a very short time. So that had happened. We look at the fathers, the patriarchs, Abraham, and we were just considering what God had promised to him. There was Abraham, and then he had his son Isaac, who was righteous. And then Isaac and his wife Rebekah, who was righteous, they had twin sons. That's, of course, Jacob and Esau. And the Lord said that there were two manner of people, two different kinds of nations that were in Rebekah's womb when the twins, before they were born. They were different as people, and their nations were going to be different. The nation of Edom that resulted from Esau, his descendants, that's another nation that was a neighbor of Israel, like the descendants of Lot, and also another nation that God gave an inheritance to the Edomites, and he forbade Israel from destroying them. But what kind of a nation were they? Different than Israel, different than Jacob. Very wicked. What was the direct cause of? Because we can look at the parents. did Esau have a different upbringing than Jacob, his twin brother? I mean, how do you raise twins entirely differently? How can you have, I mean, if I'm not talking about it separated from birth. I mean, here you have these twins of the very same parents, and they grow up in the same house. Twins born the same day, raised by the same parents. Did they have a different upbringing? Did Isaac and Rebecca teach one thing to Jacob and teach something entirely different to Esau? Or did they train them in the Lord's ways? Did they teach them who God was? Both of them. They got the same training. There's no question about that. Wasn't the same heart. But what happened? What directly led to the descendants of Esau, the nation that came from him, Edom, to where they were completely wicked? Very quickly. Well, all we have to do is read Genesis 36, 1-3, that says, "Now these are the generations of Esau, who is Edom. Esau took his wives of the daughters of Canaan, Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, and Aholibamah, however you say that, the daughter of Anna, the daughter of Zibion the Hivite, and Bashemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebajoth." He married those women of the land. Genesis 26, going back a few chapters before, in verses 34 and 35, when it actually happened, it says, "And Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Beeri the Hittite, and Bashemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, which were a grief of mind unto Isaac and to Rebekah." Those daughters-in-law that Isaac and Rebekah got were a grief to their mind. Why? Was it because they were ugly? Well, it doesn't make any comment about what they looked like. That's not the reason. It was the kind of hearts they had. What kind of people were they? I mean, they may have been the prettiest girls in all the land, but whatever. But they were awful people. I mean, they were not interested in righteousness. These were wicked women. And that's who Esau married. And then Genesis chapter 27 and verse 46, it says, "And Rebekah said to Isaac, I am weary of my life because of the daughters of Heth." Now, how bad do your daughters-in-law have to be where it makes you weary of your life? You're just tired to death. He says, "If Jacob take a wife of the daughters of Heth, such as these which are the daughters of the land, what good shall my life do to me?" I mean, that was her other son, and if he married women like what Esau had done, she's looking at all her work as a mother. She knows what are her grandchildren by Esau going to be like and the descendants to come? Well, we know, and that's what happened. And if Jacob does the same thing, then what is she looking at as far as all her work on this earth as a mother? I mean, everybody likes to count their children and grandchildren and great-grands and all that, and if the Lord blesses somebody to see all that. But, I mean, how much joy is there if you get to say it? I've got 20-something wicked grandchildren. I've got over 40 or 50 wicked great-grands now. I mean, no one is going to have joy in that. Nobody who's righteous. And so she's looking down the line of what good is her life and all that she's been on the earth to do as a mother if Jacob marries women like Esau did and that happens with him. And so that's what she was looking at. And so she was really despairing of all of that. I mean, what's the point of all that she's done in her days as a mother if that's what happens? So the next thing, as chapter 28 begins, Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said to him, "Thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, thy mother's father, and take thee a wife from thence of the daughters of Laban, thy mother's brother." And so Isaac did that, and then it tells us how when Esau saw that Isaac had blessed Jacob and sent him away to Padan Aram to take him a wife from thence, and that as he blessed him, he gave him a charge, saying, thou shalt not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan, and that Jacob obeyed his father and his mother and was gone to Padan Aram. And Esau, seeing that the daughters of Canaan pleased not Isaac his father, then went Esau unto Ishmael and took unto the wives which he had Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife. Did that fix the problem? Well, I guess they just particularly don't like those Canaanite women. Let me go get it some Ishmaelite women. I mean, was that going to fix the problem? I mean, that, of course, just compounded his errors. And then later on, we have the example of King Solomon himself, which we want to get to next time, Lord willing, because this example is going to be brought up by Nehemiah, because sadly, what this situation that Ezra is going to deal with is also going to have to be dealt with a few years later when Nehemiah comes to the land to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem. And the people are going to be doing the same thing that they're doing here that Ezra has to deal with here in Ezra chapter 9. So it tells us in Ezra 9, too, that they had taken of their daughters for themselves and for their sons, so that the holy seed have mingled themselves with the people of those lands. Yea, the hand of the princes and rulers have been chief in this trespass. So that's what led these people to becoming like the world in Ezra's time. That's what he stepped into, to see the spiritual situation there. And it happened the same way it happened to Esau, the same way it happened going back chronologically, the same way it happened in the time before Noah, which led to the world becoming fully wicked except for only eight people. And then later we can see what happened to Esau and what led him into wickedness or into all of his descendants, to leading to an entire wicked nation. And then we have saw what happened with that generation, the second generation was in Canaan, that married the people of the land, breaking God's commandment, and they were converted to the world and did the things of the people of the world, and the same things being done here. But Solomon did it too. So we'll stop for here because we're out of time, but Lord willing, next week we'll look at more of this, and then what was done underneath Ezra's leadership to address this situation that's going to take us through the rest of chapter 9 and chapter 10, really, the rest of the book for that matter. So Lord willing, we'll continue there in our study next Lord's Day. Appreciate everybody being here this morning, and we'll close by going to our Heavenly Father in prayer now.